humans face a lot of ethical dilemmas when it comes to our animal cousins in the wild. Is it okay to kill one kind of animal to protect another? Should we provide food for animals if their food chain is disrupted by human-caused development or climate change? Can we take animals into captivity for our education, our entertainment, or in an attempt to preserve a species? Our next guest tackles those questions and more in her new book, and she says we should always include the interests of individual animals in our decision-making process. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do we humans owe our wild animal cousins? Do we owe them protection, security in a world that we've changed? Do you have questions for our guest about the ethics of our relationship with nature? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emma Maris is an environmental writer and the author of the book Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Her latest book, published this summer, is called Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Emma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
With those few questions I gave there and other ones you tackle in your book, I think a lot of us might have a gut response, a gut answer. It seems like your project in the book, though, is to get us to think more deeply about the values we put on animals. Can you talk about what you're hoping we come away thinking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of us, we kind of grew up with this idea that when it comes to wild animals, our overriding job is to just leave them alone, to let nature take its course. And in some of my previous writing, I've looked into how much humans have affected nature over the last, not just few hundred years with climate change and things like that, but even over millennia. And so if we've radically altered nature, my next question was, how can we then, quote unquote, let nature take its course? Aren't all of these wild animals just living in our world? And I think they are. And I think that means we have perhaps different responsibilities to them other than just leaving them alone.
And one key to that responsibility, as you write, is trying to recognize what an interest is for an individual animal. And as in your subtitle, thinking about freedom and flourishing when it comes to those individual animals. It seems like it's hard to do, to put ourselves in their mindset, to think about what they need, what their rights and desires are. How can we do that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely challenging for me. I think of myself as a conservationist. I've written mostly about conservation, and conservationists tend to think about animals as just units in a population, more or less. You know, as long as they're out there in the wild and their reproductive rate is high enough, then we're all good. The sort of needs and the inner life of individual animals is not something that I thought about as much. I was so focused on biodiversity and not on their lives. And it is really tricky because you can't just sit down and ask them, you know, what constitutes a good life for you, ground squirrel. You have to kind of use science and what scientists have found out and inferences and analogy. And sometimes you just have to accept that you don't know and you won't know.
I want to talk about some of the specific examples you talk about in your book. And one, I gave that up front there. You spent time on islands where there are very rare species of bird, and there's this great effort to protect them in part by killing lots and lots of animals, including things like rats. How do you start to weigh that balance?
Yeah. So this was one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is because I found myself increasingly writing about these kind of conservation projects that were focused on this very real and very common threat to species, which is introduced predators on islands. This dynamic doesn't play out as much on continents. Like in Wisconsin, it's probably not as much of a big deal. But in places like Hawaii or New Zealand or even Australia, this dynamic is really common, which means that conservationists are killing lots of animals all the time. Rats, cats, foxes. This is like a major part of their work. And that kind of blew me away. And it also made me wonder about how you balance the lives of these individual animals against this sort of abstract notion of a species.
Is the answer to the question, should we kill one kind of an animal to save another species, is that answer going to be the same wherever we go?
No, yes. That's the right answer, is that the answer is not going to be the same in all of the situations. This is a super case-by-case situation, I think. I can't tell your listeners that it's okay or not okay to kill in order to save species. I think that there's so many complicating factors. How many animals are you going to have to kill? Are you going to have to just eradicate them once, or is this going to be a annual culling? What kind of animals are you killing? What kind of animals are you saving? How many are you killing? How many are you saving? How genetically distinct is the endangered animal from related species or subspecies? What are the cultural factors? Who cares about these animals, and why do they care about them? What cultural connections do they have? So it is a very complicated ethical question in every single case, and it's always going to be a little different.
We're talking to Emma Maris about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. She tackles ethical questions in conservation and wildlife. You can join in if you have something you've been thinking about, a question for our guest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Norm is with us in Oneida County. Norm, hi.
Hello there. I wanted to talk a little about the wolf issue, what we've done to the wolf in the past and what we're doing to the wolf now. For example, when he got off the list, President Trump, the first thing he did was just before he left office, he took the wolf off the endangered species list. Wisconsin immediately opened a season in February where they slaughtered over 200 wolves during the breeding season. We now have another hunting season coming up here in Wisconsin in November, and who knows how many wolves we're going to take. We chased them down with snowmobiles. We chased them down with dogs. We drove the wolf to extinction here at one time, and it just bothers me what we're doing to the wolf now.
Norm, thanks a lot for that call. And Emma, this is a long-running issue here in Wisconsin, the gray wolf
yes,
being
I'm
on
aware.
And off. Sure. So how do you start to look at the ethics of should we have gray wolves? What numbers do we try to set? How much, if at all, should we be hunting them? How do you start to tackle a debate like that?
Well, your debate really does, include a lot of the issues that I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're really just focused on the happiness of individual wolves and you're very wolf focused, you might say never kill any wolves ever should be there should never be any hunting. Then again, if you are focused on the individual happiness of some of their prey species, you might say, actually, we can't have too many wolves. Otherwise, the predation pressure will be too high on the deer, and I care about the welfare of the deer. From an ecological or conservation perspective, it's another question then altogether. And I've noticed that in the Wisconsin case, some of the objections to this second hunting season are that it would be bad for the population, that it's too many to have a robust and genetically rich population. So that's more of a conservation take. But then other people like Norm say that it just bothers them. He said, it bothers me when these animals are hunted. And I think that that's much more of an emotional response to the individual fates of individual wolves. So it's often the case that this stuff gets mixed up intertwined in when we talk about policies, the conservation population dynamics and our care for individual sentient beings. And sometimes I even see conservation organizations kind of taking advantage of that, using our sympathy for individual wolves, for example, to rally around the saving of a wolf subpopulation. So it's important to think about what we're thinking about. Do we care about this wolf right over here, this individual, or do we care about the persistence of the population in the area?
Norm, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And Emma, that reminds me, you talk about it in both of your books. You talk about our concept of what is wild. Is anything wild anymore? And the wolf, it's a great example of that, how wolves are dogs. Dogs are wolves in a lot of ways, and how the conservation effort tries to keep today's wolves away from today's dogs. Could you weigh in on that a little?
Yeah, I have a chapter in my book where I talk about this, about how, current conservation policy is very much opposed to hybridization of an endangered species with a common species, like a wolf with a dog. And that's partly just because it would be very confusing, sort of bureaucratically, to figure out what to do with the offspring. Are they to be protected and managed like wild animals, or are they basically feral dogs and we need to send the dog catcher out? But I think it also just speaks to these categories in our minds and this notion that there's a kind of a purity to the non-human wild world and that naturalness is the core value is, I think it's a real red herring for conservation. I think it's really the wrong way to look at it. I mean, we love the diversity of the world around us because it's so complicated and interesting. But I think that when we get hung up on purity, like it has to be only native species, or it has to look the way it did in 1850 or before white people got here, these different kind of baselines, then we're straying out of the science and into some very different, more culturally values-based conversations. So in this whole book, I basically reject the notion that naturalness is good in and of itself, that things being separate from humans is good in and of itself. I think the way to save nature is to have a better relationship with it, not to exile ourselves from it.
We're talking to environmental writer Emma Maris about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a thought on the ethics of conversation of wild animals and how humans relate to them? When should we take animals in captivity? In, if ever, in a zoo, in an effort to help a species survive? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about environmental ethics and the relationship between humans and the other animals we share the planet with. Emma Maris is with us. Her new book is called Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Green Bay. Mike, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I think the controversy between species and individuals is a good one, an interesting one. I'm less supportive of those activities that protect the individuals. I think things like habitat destruction, encroachment from human development, and other issues like that are really impacting the survival of species in general. And I really don't like the thought of zoos having to put animals in zoos to preserve species. Obviously, habitat development around the world really is a tricky thing to do as human population keeps growing.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a couple big issues there. Let's start with habitat, Emma, and you write about the human footprint. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Mike's correct that habitat loss is probably still the biggest threat to wild animal populations, even more so than climate change at this point. Animals do have a certain amount of adaptability in order to deal with changes in their environment, but if you completely transform their environment into a farm or a highway, then they can't cope with that. So it is pretty impactful, the amount of the habitat that we have already converted as a species to sort of human needs. We're looking at something on the order of half the surface of the planet. So I talk a lot in the book about making more physical space for wild animal populations. And in some of the cases where I talk about complicated ethical conundrums, we wouldn't have to make these complicated ethical decisions if these animal populations were doing better and just had more space. So that's one way to avoid having to break your brain with complicated ethics, is to just preserve these populations at high abundances.
Mike, thanks for that call. And Mike also brought up zoos. You talk about that in the book. You wrote a piece in the New York Times opinion section. Can you share your thoughts on the ethics of zoos and animals in captivity there?
Yeah, so Mike's opinion there, I think, is pretty widely shared. There's a lot of people who don't love the idea of animals being cooped up in zoos, and they get a feeling that maybe some of those species aren't happy there, but they feel like it's important for conservation. And I think I kind of thought along those same lines too. But when I really dove into the research about how much zoos do or do not contribute to conservation, I was sort of surprised. I don't think they do as much as a lot of us think they do. For example, currently the American Association, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums here in North America, they are involved in something like 50 different captive breeding programs for endangered species, which is awesome, but they also hold more than 5,000 different species. So that means the vast majority of the species that are in zoos are not actually part of a conservation breeding program. They're just being bred for us to look at them. And that was a surprise to me, and I think it's a surprise to a lot of readers. I would like to see zoos focus only on that kind of conservation breeding piece, and in places, in situations where those animals might actually get back out into the wild someday. But just breeding tigers and elephants for us to look at when they're not really happy in the zoo, I don't think that's something we should be doing.
One argument for zoos, and you tackle this in your book, is the idea that if we could see these animals firsthand, we might have a better chance of developing empathy for them and having an interest in their preservation, not just in the zoo, but in the wild. What do you say to that?
Yeah, this too was something that I was interested in and looked at the research in. I looked at some papers that the AZA even suggested to me. I said, sort of, give me your best evidence that this is a thing. And I wasn't that impressed by the data. You know, something like 27% of zoo visitors even bother to read the signs. There are definitely cases of individuals who became really inspired to go into conservation or wildlife management by experiences at the zoo. But most zoo goers just don't have that kind of conversion experience. They go there, they look at the cool animals, they get an ice cream, they call it a day. It has not convinced me that they are a significant shaper of public opinion when it comes to conservation and environmental protection.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking to Emma Maris about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Let's go to another caller now. Bob is with us in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you for this program. Rather than seeing animals in a zoo, I'm interested in seeing animals in the wild, and I'm curious to know your guest's opinion on what I guess I would call ecotourism. If I wanted to go see, I've always wanted to go to the Galapagos, or I would like to see gray whales in the Gulf of California, and I've got to take a jet to get there, and I'm sure there are all sorts of tourist service that contribute when I get there to the support of these environments and animals, but is that still a good thing to do that, or should I not travel anymore and not go to these places?
Great question, Bob. Ecotourism, Emma.
Yeah, that is a great question. And one that I've struggled with myself. You know, I went to the Galapagos for this book and I was, you know, asking myself, should I be getting on this plane? I think that we should go and we should see these things if we can afford it, if we're in the lucky position of being able to take these adventuresome trips and seeing this wonderful wildlife. Because I think that when it comes to climate change and worrying about our individual footprints, that is ultimately not going to be the way that we solve climate change, is by individual sacrifice. The way I think we're going to solve climate change is by sweeping systemic policy changes. Now, those might make it more expensive or difficult to fly for a while, and then maybe the decision will be made for us. Or maybe the big policy changes will spur industry to come up with a way for us to be able to fly to Ecuador without contributing to climate change. I am very, very excited for the future of carbon neutral aviation. So I think that Bob should go. And I think the Galapagos is actually a great choice because the way they have managed their tourism impact there is very impressive. And I think a lot of the money he would spend on that trip would definitely go towards protecting the animals he wanted to go see.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Emma, in our last few minutes, you mentioned some values that you think should not be at the center of our thinking about conservation, like the idea of, you know, pristine wilderness and that kind of thing. You closed the book focusing on some of the attitudes you think are positive and good ways to approach these issues. Can you share a couple of those with us?
Well, I do think that even though I spent most of my career thinking mostly about biodiversity, I do think that the sort of well-being or flourishing, including the freedom of individual animals, is something that is valuable. And when we're trying to decide how and whether to intervene in their lives, we should think about their individual well-being as well as their success as a species. But I also think that biodiversity is extremely valuable. And I think we should all work hard to protect that. And whether that means protecting more habitat, coming up with more carbon or carbon neutral ways to fly, all of those things. We need to be doing all that stuff. But as we kind of work out what our role is in all this, I think we should really try to prioritize our sense of humility. So sometimes doing something is necessary to save something or to help an animal, but sometimes not doing anything and letting the other species come up with a solution might be the better approach. I don't think that we should arrogantly think that we can manage the entire world and every animal that lives in it. I think that's a path towards a bad future.
In just our last minute, you write in your book that sometimes those values you just listed come into conflict with each other. Can you make the case that we should individually and as a society wrestle with these issues and realize that there may not be easy answers to every question?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I could give you a formula for how to deal with wild animals in the changing world, but I can't. Ultimately, every decision is going to need to be made case by case. And sometimes when you're weighing values that are in the sort of a different currency, like biodiversity against suffering, you're just going to have to make the call. And there may be many situations where there's no perfect win-win solution. We are going to have trade-offs. It's a tough world out there. We've gotten ourselves into a pickle, and it's going to be difficult to elegantly take care of ourselves and our fellow planetary dwellers in a way that doesn't break any eggs. So we have to do the best we can with care, compassion, and humility.
Emma, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
Emma Maris is an environmental writer. Her books include Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. We've been talking about her latest book out this summer. It's called Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. You could share your thoughts, your reactions to what she had to say over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.